Welcome to Worlds Apart. The political map of the world as it exists today is in large part the result of the anti-colonial struggle of the 20th century, which created many more states without necessarily unchaining them from economic or political dependence. National destiny, sovereign decision-making, fair world order, and freedom not to be in servitude to somebody else's interests. Those issues are as relevant today as they were 50 or 60 years ago. What will it take to have them mapped out once and for all? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Philani Mthembu, Executive Director of the Institute for Global Dialogue in South Africa. It's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, we are recording this interview on the sidelines of the Valdai Discussion Club, and many Russians are delighting in drawing the parallels between the anti-colonial struggle of the last century and this I think, growing anti-hegemonic sentiment of present days. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
Well, it is. I mean, if you look at a number of the countries, who are represented here, I think there is a strong consensus that hegemony has not worked for our development. I mean, if you look at South Africa, you look at African countries, and you look at other regions of the global south, they have opposed hegemony because they have borne the brunt of that. And I think there is consensus that the world should be moving towards a multipolar world order, not for the purpose of just moving to a multipolar world order, but also because many countries believe that that would also strengthen the multilateral system.
Mm-hmm. Now, what we call hegemony, the Americans call their leadership, and they believe that it's pretty benevolent, that this is actually a force for good in the world. Sure, there are some mistakes, but the intentions ultimately, at least in the American perception, are good. What's wrong with that picture of the world?
Well, what's wrong with it is it actually moves us away from a system, a rules, you know, based system.
This
is exactly the distinction I want to make, because we often hear, you know, about international law, but then we also hear about a rules based system. So you ask yourself, what is this rules based system that they speak of when you have a UN charter which actually lays out the principles of international law? And often it moves away from that system. And I think what many countries are actually calling for is a return and an embrace of the UN Charter. And I think there is a fear around the world that we have been moving away from that. So what has become interesting, and not just now, but in the last few years, is that some of the countries that actually led the creation of the UN system are the very countries that are actually moving away from it, including other multilateral fora, whether it's the World Trade Organization. You are seeing that some of the countries that actually played a proactive role in creating these institutions are moving away from them as other countries within the global south have learned to actually work within those particular systems. And I think that's a worrying trend.
I've heard some experts here at the Valdai Forum argue that the neoliberal system is a little bit like apartheid. It's a system of entrenched privilege. And sure, it's couched in more appealing terms and concepts, but at the core of it is the assumption that, you know, certain countries know what's best for all, that they know the right path to development, and that only they deserve to be the guardians and ultimately the beneficiaries of the global system. Even if we take that concept in its sort of positive view, do you think that's sustainable given the diversity in the world today?
It will never be sustainable. I mean, the world is too big, too diverse, too complex for a concentration of power if you think you can solve global problems by essentially using one particular method and way of thinking, you're deluding yourself. So by moving towards a multipolar order, where you actually embrace a diversity of thinking, where you embrace leadership from different regions of the world who are better able to understand and analyze the challenges that they are facing, you know, you actually give yourself a better chance of solving global problems. But when you concentrate power within, let's say, the United States and Western Europe, there is no way that you are going to solve very complex global problems.
And I think we have seen that very vividly demonstrated during the COVID-19 pandemic, when there were lots of calls for, you know, meeting that challenge together, but at the same time, a lot of very selfish behavior on the part of some of the richest countries. And I remember at that time I've interviewed a number of African speakers, African thinkers, and they were all saying that Africa needs to use that example to learn the lesson and to finally rely on itself. 2 years later, do you think that has already started happening, or is are the Africans are still talking about that more than doing?
No, I think we've learned our lessons, and I think we continue to learn our lessons. I think what the pandemic has helped to do is to accelerate that thinking. So what you are seeing across Africa and in other regions of the South is you are seeing a movement towards the creation of regional value chains, the creation of a greater degree of resilience. Because the reality is that, yes, we are, you know, coming through this pandemic, or at least the worst parts of the pandemic. But the reality is that in our lifetimes, we will probably face another pandemic of, you know, that magnitude. We're also going to face other external shocks, whether it's conflict or other. And I think Africa has to learn from that. Because in the pandemic, we were forced to basically wait at the back of the queue, wait for other regions to actually send protective equipment to the continent, and to actually send us things that we have the ability to make ourselves. And so if we are integrated into the global order purely as consumers, it is not sustainable for a continent that is set to double its population by 2050. We need to be able to create regional value chains. And I think you're seeing a movement in that direction, whether it's through the Continental Free Trade Area, whether it is the African Union, having much more constructive discussions about how to engage external powers in a way that meets Africa's own development objectives.
Well, speaking about external crisis and external powers affecting Africa's well-being, I'm sure you would agree with me that this latest round of confrontation between Russia and the West, especially in the trade and financial sphere, is having a major impact on some of the countries in the global South, particularly when it comes to food and energy crisis. And first of all, I would like to ask you, if you have a sense of how those third countries, countries in the global South, feel about being subjected to the ramifications of the fight in the global North, something that they have absolutely no role in.
Well, I think especially in Africa, what we are trying to move towards is at least building some degree of strategic autonomy. It does not work in Africa's interest to reduce our external partnerships. So Africa is relatively open to external engagement. So in the last few years, you've had a lot of engagement, whether it's through the Russia-Africa summits, whether it's the China-Africa fora, India-Africa, Turkey-Africa. You've also got Japan, South Korea, and a whole range of countries, EU and obviously the US. And what Africans are saying is that we do not want to be forced to choose who to engage with. There's a famous quote from Nelson Mandela in the early 90s when he met Fidel Castro and when he met Gaddafi. and other countries were trying to say, why are you meeting with these leaders? And he said, you will not tell us who our friends are. And I think that is what Africans are essentially saying. Allow us to make independent choices of who to engage with and how to engage with those countries.
You mentioned something very interesting, that lots of those countries want to engage with Africa, and I assume they also bring with them very different styles of communication and, you know, sustaining those relationships. In what way would Africa like to communicate with its partners? Because I think it's not only about whom you have relationship with, but what kind of a relationship you have with your allies.
So in Africa, the focus is and has to be very much on development. We have a continent that is set to double its population by 2050. We'll have over 2 billion Africans. We know that pretty much close to 70% of the population is under the age of 30. So we have a young population with a lot of expectations. And so development has to be at the forefront of our engagement with international stakeholders. And so what we have at the moment, we have obviously through the African Union Agenda 2063. Agenda 2063 has certain strategic projects, which it calls catalytic projects, that it wants to engage the rest of the world in supporting, building infrastructure, integrated infrastructure. You see, the legacy of colonialism is that infrastructure was built from the point of extraction of mineral resources to the ports. So it was never an integrated infrastructure. And I think what Africans are essentially saying today to the outside world is work with us, but work with us on the basis of our own priorities. And of course, that will not always be the case. But the objective from the African side is certainly to get these countries to support existing African initiatives.
You mentioned the legacy of colonialism, and a few months ago, I had a chance to interview a former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Imran Khan, before he was pushed out of power. And he said one very interesting thing, that one of the consequences of colonialism is that you stop appreciating yourself for who you are. You are always sort of psychologically inferior to somebody else, and you tend to doubt that you have this mental and psychological capacity to build your own future. Do you think Africa is fully over that right now after, you know, many decades of what I think was enforced dependence? Because as you mentioned, many of the projects that were supposedly intended to help Africa actually made it dependent and were exploitative of your land.
And you know, the important thing there is that, you know, a person like Steve Biko mentioned that the most powerful weapon in the hands of the colonizer is the mind, you know, of the colonized. And so if Africans and other parts of the world are to move beyond, you know, the scars of oppression and the scars of colonialism, importantly, what it begins with is how are we educating, you know, the next generations to become more self-aware, to become more assertive, to become more confident, you know, in themselves. It is not a rejection of the other. So it is not a rejection of external education or of external institutions, but it is an affirmation of the self, an affirmation of your history, of your culture. And I think young people are expressing that in Africa through different ways, using modern technology, but ultimately expressing themselves as Africans. And I think we're going to see that expand, you know, with time, to a point where it makes it a point that even the political leadership in Africa knows that they have to assert African values, African standards, African priorities when they engage with the rest of the world.
Okay, well, we have to take a very short break right now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
So what we've got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense?
Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Philani Mthambu, Executive Director of the Institute of Global Dialogue in South Africa. Mr. Mthambu, before the break, you mentioned on this need to be self-affirmative and to have enough stamina to know what your interests are and to defend them. And I think we would all agree with that sort of hero spirit, but It usually comes at a cost. And I remember, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when Russia was very poor and very vulnerable in terms of its own self-perception, we were liked in the West. But nowadays, once we started defending what is important for us, our national interest, we are facing enormous pressure from the West. The same happened, you mentioned Muammar Gaddafi. I remember Libya both before the intervention of NATO and after, which essentially turned that fairly well-developed African country into one large slave market right now. So when you talk about the need for Africa to stand up for itself, are you aware of the potential ramifications and conflicts that it may bring to your land?
No, definitely. And I think perhaps in the past, there was an element of naivety with you know, some of the political leadership within the continent. And I think if you are going to become more assertive, then you do have to build a stronger material base, because we have to understand that, I mean, within the African context, it works to the benefit of others to keep Africa, you know, at a low level of development. Because the moment that African countries actually assert themselves, develop, regulate, you know, the actions of multinational corporations.
Yeah, all that wealth will stay within Africa
exactly.
Rather than go to the West.
And instead of shipping those resources for very cheap, they will actually compel external companies to produce closer to their markets. So in order to do that, I think we do not have to be naive and just assert ourselves rhetorically, but we have to actually build a power base, build a material base for that assertiveness. And that means getting our economies right. That means actually governing our societies in a way that benefits our societies. And I think that is something that the new generation of political leadership in Africa has to do.
Mm-hmm. And I think it also includes, you know, being very mindful of what your partners want and being able to, you know, play their interests to your advantage. You mentioned before that there are lots and lots of various African fora, you know, American, Chinese, Russian, Turkish, Japanese, etc. And these countries offer very different developmental models, particularly China, which is always criticized in the West for the way it does business in Africa. I know you've studied it professionally and academically. Give us a brief sense of how they're different. Let's say the Western way of reaching out to Africa and the Chinese way of doing that.
So you mentioned, for instance, earlier about, you know, how post-colonial societies at times have a sense of even inferiority. But the inverse is also true in terms of former colonial powers who are not able to shake their own sense of superiority. And so what I think is quite unique, let's say, with the Chinese model is that we cannot replicate the Chinese model, but we can certainly learn certain things. And one of the things we can learn is that it is based on their own endogenous development systems. So China picks and chooses what it wants to use from the West and from other regions of the world. But its model of development is very much founded on its own history, its own culture. And I think that is something that we can take. We need to interrogate whether our political systems whether our laws, whether our ways of doing business are actually aligned to our interests. We can also learn that you need political will to actually sustain, you know, your development model as different countries. Because certainly when China began opening up and reforming, many in the West looked at it and said they're never going to achieve these development plans. They were ridiculed. And I think we have to be prepared to accept also that.
Now, I also want to ask you about the Russian role in Africa. At this point of time, Russia is mostly involved in the mining sector and the security sector, both of which are very lucrative and very sensitive, and I would also add very secretive. Given that there is very little public oversight in those sectors, I want to ask you directly, what kind of a player is Russia in Africa? Is it being honest to the people and to the land?
Well, one of the things, obviously, because of the Soviet history, it has that historical legacy. In fact, many Africans would have been asking themselves why Russia engaged less. But of course, we understand the challenges that it had, you know, in the early 90s and so forth. So in that sense, I think Russia within Africa, yes, is engaged in the security sector and the mining sector and the energy sector. Now, these are obviously important sectors because when we talk about security, we're talking about many countries that are still struggling to actually assert a degree of sovereignty over their territory. So obviously, it provides opportunities for security or cooperation. Energy also, energy security is a big challenge within Africa, so that provides opportunities for Russia. And of course, mining, we're a rich continent. But another area that I think we do not speak about enough is the agricultural sector. I mean, Russia is an agricultural power. And when we are talking about issues of food security within Africa, we do have arable land, quite a lot of arable land, but we do not produce enough of our own food to become self-sufficient. And I think this opens an opportunity for Russia to actually not only trade with Africa, but to work with African stakeholders to actually increase their own output. So if you combine mining and agriculture, you can actually be mining phosphorus, you can actually be making fertilizers and improving actually Africa's own agricultural produce. So there's a lot of opportunity there to not only focus on those traditional sectors.
But in order for those opportunities to be realized, I think what will be required is not only Russia's political and economic will, but also the readiness of local partners to deal with Russia despite all the potential ramifications. Plus, there are also associated security risks because investments in agriculture are low margin and long term. Do you think Africa has enough to offer at this point?
And remember that we're also dealing in a context where the US has particular legislation that is supposed to punish countries that are actually increasing their cooperation with Russia.
Even if it's for the purpose of providing food for their people.
Exactly. And I think that is why we have to be assertive. So when Blinken came to South Africa recently, he was told in a very assertive manner by South Africa's Minister of Foreign Affairs that we will not accept being dictated to by other countries. And I think what Africa needs is not all, but a few strong regional countries that are going to assert Africa's interests within the world. But that assertion has to be constant. And that gives some umbrella of protection for other countries to actually engage with whomever they want to.
Now, speaking about this potential green revolution in Africa, green revolution is such a loaded term because in the United States, it was done under the slogan of feeding the people, but it also led to a substantial decrease in biodiversity. And overall, the benefits of that kind of agriculture are very questionable. I know that this is an issue in South Africa as well, because Monsanto is very much present there. When you talk about agricultural cooperation, what do you have in mind? And do you think actually that the United States and Russia could make Africa a battleground for that very different style of agriculture and approaching to the approach to nature?
No, and I think this is where we need to actually define very clearly the model that we want to actually take, because part of the challenge in Africa's agricultural space is that you have countries that are in the agricultural space but are largely growing cash crops for the market. Now, some of these cash crops are not drought resistant and are not actually well, are not really the type of crops that you would want to put all your resources into. I mean, you take an example like Southern Africa, where we have indigenous crops, which we are not really growing in sufficient numbers that we should be, crops that are drought resistant. So we need a balance between cash crops for the market and actually food crops, you know, to feed our populations, crops that are actually strong and that can outlive, you know, certain drought conditions. And I think that's what we need to do. But also what we need to do is learn from the bad lessons that we have seen in other parts of the world. So you can't just have culture and just, you know, growing one particular type of crop for the market. That's where we need a bit of diversity, but also we need smaller scale farming. And actually to be able to grow crops closer to the communities that are going to be consuming those crops. It can't be that, you know, it's cheaper to bring in chickens from the United States than it is to actually have your own poultry industries in your own country.
Well, it can within the capitalist system.
Exactly.
Which leads me, I guess, to my final question, because the new South African government is an object of fascination here in Russia, because we have long abandoned any Marxist or socialist ideas, and I think that also has something to do with our own sense of vulnerability or defeat, if you want, ideological defeat in the past. But we are seeing from the South African government that it's not timid to explore some of those ideas in practice and to be able to consider, for example, the long-term consequences of agricultural policy, which you cannot do within the capitalist system where you only consider the profits. Here you're talking about the impact on the communities, the impact on the environment. How do you see socialism or Marxism or, you know, this new form of governance that's more oriented towards society play out in the 21st century compared to, let's say, the 20th century?
Yeah. I mean, South Africa gained its majority rule at the time when neoliberalism was basically the only ideology in town. But I think what you still have in South Africa, you still have a desire, especially from within members, some members at least, of the governing party, to explore ideas like socialism and to see how you can actually bring it about in reality. Now, of course, it's a contested space. I mean, the governing party in South Africa calls itself a broad church. You have capitalists, you have Marxists, you have, you know, socialists. You have a number of ideologies at play, which sometimes works in our favor and sometimes not. But I do think, you know, it's still fertile ground to explore certain ideas rather than purely adopting a neoliberal approach to development.
Yeah, monocrops don't work even in the ideological sphere.
Exactly.
Well, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.